Well, professors, not his kids?
No, they're Elizabeth Mitchell's kids. His kids are college age stuff. So yeah, one of our PS is a mother, and so she brings, she brought her kids to move Star Trek. She loves it. And the Star Trek was good, by the way. But they'll post the email at home, so I recommend you come see it. The other thing I wanted to mention is I hope now that we're getting more used to using the web page for your web discussions, that you explore everything that's on the web page. As we get closer to the midterm, you're going to find that four-column page very useful for reviewing. It has not just the same, it has the passages that you're given in lecture, but it also has expanded background notes. So if you have trouble understanding some of the connections in lectures sometimes, go to the, that lecture on the web page and check out the notes and see if that helps. There's also on the more resources page lots of interesting links if you from very simple things, like if you can't remember like who a certain character is or something, you have a link to our Encyclopedia Mythica, which gives you like their genealogy, whatever, so you can figure out who the, these people are. There's stuff about oral composition and performance and all sorts of excellent things. So please explore the webpage, check out everything we put up there to help you. And as I mentioned on the page, we need our time for next week's discussion. Who wants to volunteer? It's a really juicy passage. And now with these dreams, I thought the keys. And the ego. You haven't gotten to it yet, but I'm telling you, it's a really good passage. You'll do it? I mean, okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to talk, I have them all today, so we're going to talk about it today as well. Okay, so before we start, are there any other questions about anything class-related? Not just administrative stuff, but content, blogging, anything. Michael, can you put your chair up? I can see you. Oh, and Jeremy, yeah, he has a you and all. He can tell you to pull your chair up. Here, I'll push it out. Not move away. Okay, so as I was saying, we're talking about one of the things we're going to talk about today is poetry and performance. The idea of composition, why you perform, and what that allows the poet to do. So, anyone here not know the story of Little Red Riding Hood? Okay. Sometimes we give people more attention. Lauren, how does the story start? How does Little Red Riding Hood start? Andrew, how does it start?
They give some sort of basket to bring to her grandma. And we'll eat the grandma.
That's not the beginning of the story. Okay, so the story starts. So, who is the biggest or the basket of food? Her mother. Right, her mother gives her a basket to take her grandmother. Why? The grandmother's sick. She's old and sick. She's a shut-in. Okay, so this is her talking to her, take the basket, and then what happens is her father.
She's walking through the woods and she meets a wolf. And the wolf asks her where she's going, and she says, I'm going to my grandmother's house. So she goes on her way, and the wolf takes a shortcut to the grandmother's house.
Okay. Anybody know a different version of what happens next?
Why doesn't the wolf eat her right then?
Maybe it's under the media.
What's the wolf like? What's the trigger?
Yeah.
Is she attracted to something?
How is she attracted?
I have a thing where he tells her that it would be nice for her to gather a bouquet of flowers to take some crap with her.
So sometimes she's got a picnic flower. Sometimes she. So the wolf then takes some kind of shortcut, right? In some versions, the wolf tells her that a different way is a shortcut, right? And she actually takes the shortcut himself. So, Christy, what happens then?
Then she gets sort of around the top. Is the wolf there?
Okay, so the wolf eats the grandmother and dresses up like her. Anybody got a different story? Sometimes he hides her, right? In a toned down Bugs Bunny version. Hides her in the closet and dresses up like her. And that's what happens. So they. Well, he dresses up like her. And we already said that the ground is supposed to be thick, right? So, Will, what do we do? Every dresses up like her. He gets in the bed. And then what happens? She arrives.
Calls her over to the bed.
Calls her over to the bed, and what's, yes, they have a conversation. JP, what's this? Right, so how does the conversation go? My grandmother, the guys you have, the sense of you, what the ears you have, et cetera, et cetera, then what happens? So then he says, the better to eat you with, right? He eats her.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the story. So, Whistling Tom's chops the wolf open, and they both pop out.
Yeah.
What about if the grandmother, what's the version you know?
I don't know. So it was a mistake, but I didn't know she did pop out.
Okay, so in that version, the Whistling Tom, the wolf like taking her around, Whistling Tom and kills her. Some versions they just get eaten.
Well, the grandmother was eating that cut, and then she screams when the wolf tries to catch her and like gets outside, which is why the wolf didn't eat her originally or whatever. And yeah, she was like outside.
Right. So the grandmother
comes out. No. The Lord of the Rising, and then the woodman comes and kills the wolf and takes care of my house.
Right.
Yeah.
So in some versions they die. In some versions they live. Some versions grandma dies, but Red Riding Hood lives. Some version. So there's also this sexy French version where which is like a sexy sexy where the conversation is completely different. So that the wolf says to her, you know, why don't you get into bed with me, keep me warm because I'm sick. And lots of other things happen, but what this is supposed to point to, that it's all her different versions of this same story, but if you hear it, you still recognize it as the story of Red Riding Hood. So if Grandma's in the closet instead of being eaten, you still recognize it as the same story, right? It's just a different version of it. Well, when a poet sings these songs, he can make up different versions, and it's still the same story. And one's not right, and one's not wrong. They're just variations on the story. And you talk about, in literary terms, this process on two axes. So one is called the axis of combination. And these are details we can include. Does she stop and pick the flowers? Or does the wolf just send her the wrong way? Those are part of the axis of combination. The details you put in the story, but it doesn't change the plot, right? One can happen, they both can happen, it doesn't matter, somehow the wolf gets to the house first, right? So these are just details within the plot. So again, in our ideas about expansion and compression, you want to expand it, you get a lot more of these, right? You can tell a lot more about each individual part of the story. The other one is called the axis of selection. And here is where you make choices about how you're going to tell the plot. So this is where I'm seeing either that you can put the plot, they can't both happen. Right? So that's on the axis of selection. You select which version you're going to tell. Does Red Riding Hood kill the wolf, or does the huntsman kill the wolf? Or does the wolf just eat Red Riding Hood, and there was no huntsman ever, or woodsman, or whatever you call him? So that's along the axis of selection, choices in the plot. And so today, when we saw the first song of Democus in Odyssey 8 in lecture, remember we had a similar plot line to the Iliad, where there was a quarrel between the Achaeans while they were fighting at Troy. But the players were arranged differently. So the poet can have these choices as to how to tell the story, whether it's Achilles having a quarrel with Agamemnon or with Odysseus. And it's not as though the audience can be like, no, that's not how it happened, right? You can tell the story either way.
Do we know that that was on the axis of selection, though? Because, I mean, it doesn't seem to preclude the possibility that there was a bigger quarrel between the Achilles and Agamemnon.
Right, it could have been
at the time.
Right.
That we could
so that it's a similar plot told at a different time. But, it is an Iliad. You know, it is a story of a quarrel at Troy. So, again, the poet can choose to tell the story as he composes his performance, can stretch it out along that combination, include lots and lots of detail, like the story of the Iliad compared to the story of Meleager, which is very compressed, so that you don't get a lot of the detail in it. You know that his mother's mad at him, but the poet doesn't tell you why. Right? Unlike, you hear a lot about why Achilles was mad at Agamemnon from Achilles himself. So, this is important when we read Homeric poetry because we know that it's composed and performed, like our friend Austin composing and performed, getting back to that. So, while we're doing our close reading, we have to keep in mind that the poet had choices of what to include and what not to include. It's not a fixed text. It's not the way it has to be. So when details are included, there's a reason why. There's an importance to the way the poet is telling the story. And especially if it's along that axis of selection, you can see the choices involved. But the axis of combination is important too. So that's something we need to look for as we read the story. Any thoughts, questions? You have to be trained because your singing is meter. And the other thing that Perry and Lord's work discovered is that if you sometimes it's hard to notice in a prose version translation, but remember how they feast all the time? And you know, these long descriptions of how they prepare the food and cook it, and they all sit down and they have their fill of eating and drinking and this and that. And then, so those are called type scenes, and those are a way for the poet to sing something that's very familiar, and he doesn't have to think about it. He can be thinking ahead to what's coming up. So that's part of the art, is that, you know, you have these type scenes, the warrior putting on his armor, the sitting down to eat, making a sacrifice. All of those things are described very similarly over and over again. So when you read it as a text, you might be like, all right, they're eating, get it, you know. But for the poet who's singing, that's a way for him to continue singing while he's thinking about what he's going to say next.
What is this called?
Type scene. Yeah. And another feature of the composition and performance is the epithet, because he's singing in meter. So when he says swift-footed Achilles, for example, sometimes people used to be bothered because he would use that epithet, swift-footed Achilles, when Achilles wasn't doing any swift running at the moment. You know, and I was, why is he calling him that? But it fills out the line, the meter. So swift-footed Achilles in Greek fills out the end of the line, so he can just use that while he gets ready to sing the next one. So he's singing within the meter as well. So all of those epithets that are used over and over again are part of the song performance.
If there are all these different spoken versions, why is there only one written version?
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, there's actually more. so we have, well, there was within the process, there was a time when scholars in Alexandria, the detail that you don't need to know, compiled all of the written versions. So they had this great library that the Romans burned, and we all have to mourn that the Romans burned it, those heathens. but they compiled all of the written ones, and as scholars, they decided which one was the right version. But they kept in the margins what the other versions are, and we still have that. So we actually do have alternate choices for things. It was in a long process of hundreds of years where one written version became the standard. So even after it was they started to write it down, it was performed for thousands of years before it was ever written down. And then even after it was written down for hundreds of years more, it slowly became standardized to what we have.
Would this ever be performed at one time?
Every 4 years at least. At a festival in Athens, they performed the whole meal.
How long did it take?
I don't know exactly how long it takes, but they had long attention spans when it said
So the natural symbol that we always use, like, you know, to instruct him, like, a lion stops it, and it goes, and comes, and kind of, you know, go along with the beat, and so was he like. Is that part of the composition of the poet, or is that also something they have to sort of lexicon? They're like, lion's talking sheep, okay, and they run that.
Yeah, I think that it's not quite like a type scene. I mean, there's not like a type simile.
They're always similar, but they vary the language.
Yeah, they do. I mean, lions in battle is a natural choice. There's lots of discussion about that, too, because lions don't live in groups, but... but yeah, so the similes are more artistry than a type of a placeholder kind of scene, which just kind of further the action every so slowly. So I would argue we're going to look at a simile later, but they're much more important than that.
Is Homer's version vary a lot from the ones that are scholars on the scene?
Well, Homer is the name for the tradition. So, I mean, because we are in Gregory Nagel's class, scholars dispute whether Homer was an actual person or not. And whether he was a specific poet who dictated this, because he's blind, isn't he? who dictated it to someone who wrote it down, or whether it's just a name given to the tradition of the story. So it's the authoritative name for this particular tradition of the Iliad and the Odyssey. So to say that his version differs, I mean, people could sing Homer's song and still change it, and it wouldn't be unauthoritative for them to do that. Does that make sense? I mean, it would still be called Homer. Anything else? So you'll be hearing more on Thursday, I'm not sure as well. So our web assignment this week was also about storytelling and the importance of storytelling within the Odyssey. The Odyssey, much more than the Iliad, I think, is very self-conscious about its own storytelling. and how you choose to tell a story. You'll see, because we have performances of songs within the Odyssey, you know, both in Scroll 1 and in Scroll 8, it's very self-conscious about how you tell a story, and that's why we wanted you to think about how Helen and Menelaus tell stories about their experiences in Troy. Represented. So I thought it was very interesting, because I'm fascinated with Helen myself, how you all discussed and debated Helen's motivations and administering the drug and her own story being whether it's more about herself rather than about Odysseus. And what several of you picked up on is that it's not just to, I think that the pentos part of it is not her own pentos, but that of Telemachus hearing about his father. But also it's apolos, it's to prevent anger, and the idea that she can tell a story about her part in the Trojan War without arousing the anger of those who are listening to her. And again, there's hints of Menelaus' story that might actually happen. where Menelaus is like, she ends her story by saying that she was really unhappy, she now wanted to go home. That's page 39. But for my own part, she says, I was glad, for my heart was beginning to long after my home, and I was unhappy about the wrong that Aphrodite had done me and taken me over there, away from my country, my girl, me, her daughter, and my lawful wedded husband, who was indeed by no means sufficient either in look or in understanding. And so when Menelaus responds, his story, as several of you pointed out, seems to question whether she was indeed longing to go home, since she seems to still be working on the Trojan side. And when he says, by the way, you might not have known this, and there's no reason why you should have, but when he says, some daimon who wished well to the Trojans must have set you onto it, and you had the Aphobus with you, he's her third husband. So, while she's saying, I really want to go back to my husband, Menelaus mentions, oh, by the way, you had a man with you, that other husband that you had. So Paris is dead at this point, and she married yet another Trojan afterwards. Helen, she never gave it up. And so, he brings out, here she is trying to trick the Greeks into revealing themselves and ruining and being fought of the Trojan War. And the other aspect of this is to bring out these details in, how you tell the story, how much she incriminates herself, but also this question of the emotion that storytelling evokes. And how it evokes it differently depending on who's listening. So as we saw in one of the focus passages for today, Scroll 1, when Phineas is singing about the mill story, the homecomings of the Greeks, now he comes up and says, this is playoff for you, but it's pentos for me, right? It's just a story for you guys to listen to. But this is my life that you're talking about. You're talking about my husband not returning home. So stop singing. And Telemachus says, oh, Mom, let's go. Men want to hear about the most recent stories. It's all very exciting that the Argives didn't come home. But the idea that for some of the audiences, hearing about this is a pleasant way to pass the evening as they eat up the house of Odysseus. But for us who are directly involved, It's not just that. And so you have to administer the drug, as people pointed out, in order to even be able to listen to the story. In order for sponsors to emotionally be able to deal with the story, the drug allows them to do that. And Will, I think it was you that mentioned that you actually get, he gets a perspective on the story by having the drug administered, so that, you know, it allows him to be more objective about listening to it and not just concentrate on the emotions that it evokes. But the passage that I'd like to look at is when Odysseus hears the story about himself and the emotion that it evokes in him. So we're in Scroll 8, page 89. So Odysseus is in the court of the Phaeacians, these fantastic people who have a very hard life on that island. And they have a singer in their court as well. And so he sings the first song that he sings is the very compressed one about the quarrel between Odysseus and Achilles. And what is Odysseus' reaction to that? Right, so he cries and has to, then they have a nice sports break after that. Let's have some sports instead. Because they don't want him to cry anymore. And, you know, there's all these rules about how do you treat a guest, how you approach a guest. So they don't know who he is yet, right? They haven't asked him. Because you entertain someone before you ask who they are in the system of venia, silence is the word for guest. And then he tells another nice story about the gods, Ares and Aphrodite, cheating on Hephaestus. And that's a very jovial story. And then after dinner, where we are, he tells us a third song. That Odysseus himself requests. So Odysseus says to Democritus, Democritus, there is no one in the world whom I admire more than I do you. You must have studied under the muse, Zeus's daughter, and under Apollo. In such good order do you sing the fate of the Achaeans with all their sufferings and adventures. If you were not there yourself, you must have heard it off from someone who was. Now, Hector, change your song and tell us of the making of the wooden horse, which Achaeus fashioned with the assistance of Athena, and which Odysseus got by stratagem into the fort of Troy after freighting it with the men who afterwards sacked the city. If you will sing this tale aright, I will tell all the world how magnificently heaven has endowed you. So Odysseus requests this, and this is also part of this skill of composition and performance, that you can take requests, right? So, and you can start and stop wherever. So you don't have to sing the whole thing at once. You can just sing parts of the story. And so you're supposed to be able to pick it up wherever someone asks you to start. And that's even at the very beginning of the Odyssey, in the invocation to the muse, it says in line 10, tell me, as you have told those who came before me, about all these things, O daughter of Zeus, the muse, starting from whatsoever point you choose. So the idea of the muse is like the poet of the muse, starting from whatever point you choose.
I was wondering, is it usually we always talk about class as something that develops the hero, at least in part because he's died between altitude and worship, that Odysseus is not dead yet, and he's already sort of gotten himself into the song. Like, so I guess he didn't need to die to do that.
Well, in one sense, no, he didn't need to, because he's a very different kind of hero. And remember, as we were talking in the lecture today, Hesiod is his nostril, so he's different from Achilles, and not having to have a short life. But also, the other side of that is, at this point, most people assume he's dead, because they haven't seen him for 10 years. So
you don't really, do you have to be a warrior to have that?
No.
To be a ruler?
Yes. Yes, we'll see many more of different kinds of examples now.
There's so many things where it was horrible. Mm-hmm. It seemed like there were places in the area where there were sort of, it's like recaps of like the plot from the Copenhagen back of it would repeat a whole line of,
right, it says the speech exactly the same way.
And there'd be lots of references that thought that you should have already sort of known. This would seem like maybe if they did this right in the product, there'd be sort of like an international show where they
get it. Right, exactly.
It's also a way, it's a way that we were talking about before, like where the poet can just repeat what it already says.
Right, so once you've composed the messenger's speech where it says to the messenger, go and tell Achilles, blah, 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 and I'll give him X, Y, and Z, and then they come, and it's like, and he says blah, 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 and we X, Y, and Z, and it's exactly the same. So yeah, it's like, again, a feature of the oral composition where the poet can just read that over again. But here Odysseus has a special request for a topic of song. He wants to hear about the Trojan horse. So the singer starts with a prayer, and he takes up the story. Again, this idea of, I can start anywhere. I'm a virtuoso singer. Took up the story at the point where some of the Argives set fire to their tents and sailed away, while others, hidden within the horse, were waiting with Odysseus in the Trojan place of assembly. So the Trojans themselves had drawn the horse into their fortress, and it stood there while they sat in council around it, and were in three minds as to what they should do. Some wanted to destroy it, others wanted to throw it off the wall, while yet others were for letting it remain as an offering and propitiation for the gods. And this was how they settled it in the city, or in the end, for the city was doomed when it took in that force within which were all the Greeks of the Argives, waiting to bring death and destruction on the Trojans. Then he sang how the sons of the Achaeans issued from the horse and sacked the town, breaking out from their ambuscade. He sang how they overran the city here and there and ravaged it, and how Odysseus went raging like Ares along with Menelaus to the house of Deiphobus to get Helen. So here, that's why they're going to that particular house, because she's living with Deiphobus now. It was there that the fight raged most furiously, nevertheless, by Athena's help, he was victorious. All this he told, but Odysseus was overcome as he heard him, and his cheeks were wet with tears. He wept as a woman weeps when she throws herself on the body of her husband who has fallen before his own city and people, fighting bravely in defense of his home and children. She wails aloud and flings her arm about him as he lies gasping for breath and dying. But her enemies beat her from behind about the back and shoulders and carry her off into slavery, to a life of labor, pomp, and sorrow, and the beauty fades from her cheeks. Even so piteously did Odysseus weep, but none of those present perceived his tears except Alcinous, who was sitting near him and could hear the sobs and sighs that he was heaving. So Odysseus' reaction is to the song that he wanted to hear. What?
Lamentation.
Extreme grief. Why? This is the song about his victory, right? This is the song, this is the story about what should be his playoff, that he was the one who allowed the Greeks to defeat the Trojans. Yeah.
I guess in the seminary or whatever, he's talking about a woman who should be rejoicing, her husband's dead, but he's thinking that she's some great glory or something like that, so by all rights, she should be held on the team by her people, but then she's getting
so the interaction with the simile in the outer story, it's the simile, and this is kind of what I was talking about with Jeremy's point. The simile has much more to do than just the extent of his weeping. The details involved in the simile of this woman are going to tell us a lot more about Odysseus and his reaction. So one of the things, as Matt was saying, that his life is now this life of labor and sorrow. He doesn't get to enjoy the playoff that he should have achieved in Troy because of what has happened since then. What else about the simile? If I ask you to do close reading and simile, what else would you say is important about the way he's described it as weeping? Does it surprise any of you that he's described as a woman?
Yeah.
Why? He's so manly. Who are some of the women you would think of that would put this kind of represent? If you were thinking of a woman weeping, his wife, right? We hear a lot about his wife weeping over him. And she herself says she cries every night, right? We hear about that. Hector's wife. What's her name? Andromache. Good. So Andromache is, you know, a key figure for a woman taken into captivity after her brave husband dies, right? That would be your paradigm of who this captive woman would be. So Andromache, we saw in the Iliad weep over her dead husband, Hector. Do we all remember Andromache and Hector's song, right? Cute little boy who, you know, was afraid of his father's father. Sinai, right? Does anyone know what happened to Sinai? By whom?
One of the Greeks.
I wonder who it could be. Odysseus. Right. Odysseus and some versions of the story. Again, this is there's variation. In another version of the story, it's Neoptolemus, Achilles' son, who does it. But in one version of the story, Odysseus, again, acts as a selection, could be either one, takes his Sinex to the top of the walls of Troy and throws him down and kills him so that he can never avenge his father's death. That's a big scene. Don't want any children left around, just like Luca wanted to kill the children of Heracles so they couldn't avenge the wrongs done to his family. So Odysseus, we think when we hear the story of Andromache, who was by the death of her husband, but also the death of her child, the victim not only of Achilles, but of Odysseus. Is ringing any bells?
Is it the image, also, similarly, mm-hmm. The story is the image of like, going crying. It brings up the story of Hector's wife.
Yes.
Is that why the
description of a woman weeping when she throws herself on the body of her dead husband who's fallen before the city of people, the paradigmatic woman would be Andromache. But remember last week we talked about Achilles and Priam, right? What did we say?
That his tears were the death of his father.
So, and we talked about the connection between the two of them through their mutual sorrow, the empathy he felt for his most hated enemy. So in this simile, Odysseus is identified with his own victim, Andromache, right? And again, we have this emotional aspect of the hero with an identification with the enemy. His class isn't going to be what he did at Troy. Just like Achilles' class isn't dragging the body of Hector around. We talked last week about the shame and disgrace involved in that, and that his rehumanization was an important part of his heroism and the song culture. Odysseus isn't going to get an epic about what he did at Troy. And we saw also in one of the focus passages in the lecture today that the destruction of Troy was done badly by the Greek. It was, as Nasser himself said, it was neither just nor wrong. You say right, you're good. And that's why they were given these painful homecomings, right? Is that when they destroyed Troy, they broke the rules and he had to be punished for it. So Odysseus isn't going to get slapped for what he did at Troy.
How many times did the Greek actually destroy Troy? Because Troy was destroyed about 7 times and it was destroyed.
You're talking about the archaeological
yeah.
Troy?
That one of those layers might be the particular...
The city of Prime or Troy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that there's just one of them that's supposed to be the city of the Greeks for sure. Although it's pretty good in terms of case. But the idea that this also reminds us of Penelope, I think, is part of the complexity of assembling as well. Again, it doesn't have to just be one woman. The woman is less anonymous, but like the anonymous figure with a shield, just a woman who's crying over the death of her husband in war. So Penelope weeping, Odysseus, again, being sad that he has a life of labor and sorrow and can't get that home to his wife. That identification between the two of them adds the complexity of the simile. So this kind of this
also and also it keeps lost a lot of his closest friends. The woman's off the closest here the lost brother leaving for his
so that it's not, he's recognizing not just the triumph at Troy, but the losses that were involved to the Greek side as well, and in their homecoming.
Sure.
How many of them die after the Trojan War as well. So you're right, I mean, at this point he's all by himself, he's lost everybody else. So there can be a lot of sorrow in the recognition that even when you win a war, there's still losses involved. As well.
Well, when Achilles said that he wanted to like eat the flesh of Hector and all that stuff, he really disgraced himself, and like he said, kind of thing like an animal, part of humanity, part of the heroes, of course. When and you say that like, kind of like Odysseus did that too, I guess, playing through the song off the wall.
Right.
So he also decided into the animal, say like under like a Medusa or whatever?
It's not described that way, but the whole destruction of Troy, there's so many things in it that where they just violated all of the rules of humanity. And I mean, Odysseus, that was Odysseus' part in it. So you have, like, Cassandra, who was with the Trojans, was a suppliant at the altar. When you're a suppliant at an altar, you're not supposed to be touched. That's part of the rules. So Ajax, not our friend Ajax, but a different agent. There were two of them, as I'm sure you remember from the two agents who were all together. So the lesser agent raped her at the altar. Prime was something at the altar, and they slaughtered him at the altar. Mia Thomas, Achilles' son, did. So all of these actions are the Greek hubris. I mean, they're outraged against the city, and we're going to revisit this later when we read the Agamemnon, the tragedy Agamemnon, because of a lot of what went on at the end of Troy gets emphasized there, whereas here it's merely alluded to. You get the good part of the story, yay, the Greeks got the Trojan horse in there and won, and it's only the bad part only alluded to in a similar way.
So how does Odysseus regain his...
I think this is part of it, right here.
Yeah.
I mean, the recognition when he listens to what should be a slant of the sorrow that's involved for everybody is part of his...
So can you say that actually Odysseus' heroism was like getting to terms with what he has done and like being like compassion, like getting his soul back?
something that rage that you saw it like that's a bad thing.
This is an important part of his, you know, rehumanization. Right now, also, the idea of him, his rehumanization, when he's with his creation, he's in what in other fairy tales might call Never Never Land. I mean, these people, they don't work, and they're very happy. it's just kind of this island of bliss place. So he's kind of outside of humanity here, too. And the story that he tells, he's about to tell in Scrolls 9 through 12. Again, he's outside of regular human society, so he goes to a place where it's handled, and the Cyclops, and, Circe's Island, again, all of these very fantastical places. So he's outside of regular human society. What's going to make his Nasa successful is his successful reintegration into his family, into his human society. And so, as we read the end of it, we see how that accomplished. But it's an important part of his Nasa, which is his plan. Jeremy?
You're saying that Odysseus makes an emotional connection here with Andromache, and that before, Professor Mountain was saying in lecture that Odysseus lacked when the part is playing in the story of Troy and getting those kind of emotional connection. And then I was wondering, when did he gain it such that when he's on the test around the play, it's just the person he was hearing like a job on that?
The idea of Columbus' journey is that
to come home.